Welcome to the North and South of Things podcast, a show dedicated to discussion of topics important to the LGBT community and the community at large. Here are your hosts, Mark and George.
Welcome to the North and South of Things podcast. I'm Mark, a.k.a. the Laughing Buddha in St. Paul, Minnesota. And joining me, hopefully in sunny Atlanta, is George in Atlanta. Good morning, George.
Good morning. It is not sunny yet, but we are told it is on the way. So we're excited to be in 50, 60, 70 degree weather this time of year. Are you guys throwing snowballs up there yet?
Well, last weekend we were. We didn't really get a significant amount of snow, but I'm telling you, it's morally devastating to look out your window on the second or third Saturday in October and see snow. It's far too early.
And then we're getting ready to change time. The punches keep coming in this time. Yeah,
that's right. And we're going to be down for the count until, probably May.
Good times. Good times. Well, with that upbeat intro, let's get into today's topic. For kids, it's been a minute since we've recorded, so we thought we would bring you back a come back with a lively discussion about loss. It's a bit of a downer topic at times, but something I think we need to talk about, right, Mark?
I think it is. We really don't deal well with death, with grief and loss in our culture. I think it something that in America tends to be tucked away, and we really don't really talk about it. And, you know, we've had a significant amount of loss in our Pride 48 family in the last year or so. Of course, last winter up here in Minnesota, we lost Mags earlier to a tragic car accident in bad weather. And several Pride 48ers have lost treasured family members. We've got Big Fatty, who lost the Hatterina. We have Archer. And then Arthur and Nigel. Nigel passed away suddenly, unexpectedly, and it's kind of a whirlwind. It really, knocks the breath out of us when that sort of tragic and sudden loss happens.
It's incredibly, it's like two completely different sides of the coin in some ways. Like, when your elders are on that path, you have a sense of the inevitability and it's going to happen. But when a situation like Nigel happens, from diagnosis to passing was 10 days or something crazy like that. We know we start dying from the first day we start living, and it's going to happen at some point or another. But it seems like even in those eventualities, we still deal with a lot of pain, even though it's sort of an expected or anticipated passing.
Exactly. And today we're going to talk about how loss is marked around the world and how we cope with it here in the Western world and in the United States.
I think we probably could use some help on this, don't you think?
I really do. That's why we've asked IC Greg of the Walk the Earth and Inappropriate Conversations podcast to join us today.
Welcome, Greg. How are you?
I am good. Glad to be here.
Now, Greg, for our listeners who may not know about you or your podcast, can you give us a little bit about your background, about who you are and what you talk about on your podcasts?
Yeah, many years ago, I started Inappropriate Conversations because I felt pretty strongly that there had been this sort of segregation of ideas, and that as a society, we were increasingly unwilling to talk about politics and religion at the same time. And that was even extending into popular culture. I remember asking a friend online once if he could give me a detailed list of all the different professions who weren't allowed to have opinions about political issues or social issues, because you'd hear it so often that an athlete would speak up and everyone would tell him to stay in his lane, or an actress or a musician. As I said, it's time to bring these things together and deal with the mess of what happens when you're talking about sex, drugs, rock and roll, religion, and politics all at once. And then a few years later, the family had a bit of a crisis where we knew we were going to need to leave the church that we'd been attending for 15 years and probably change denominations, and that there was a legit risk we might not ever go to church again. And as that search for a new way to worship was going on, I decided that I needed to record about that too. And it wasn't really the Inappropriate Conversations podcast, so I started Walk the Earth.
Greg, I have to say, I listen more to Inappropriate Conversations than I do Walk the Earth. And for listeners, you definitely want to, if you have not had a chance, and you are like me, sometimes you stay away from religion and religious conversations because it's just not your bag. I strongly encourage you to listen to Greg's podcast because it's so much food for thought. I mean, Greg does a wonderful job of sort of breaking it down, talking about specific issues, current events and broader issues, and where these very touchy topics, cross paths. It's a fascinating show. I enjoy it, Greg. We appreciate you being here today. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I've long taken inspiration from the North and South of Things as well. I told myself in the very first year that I probably at some point needed to address the way we speak about trans people and trans in general, and just never had the knowledge or courage to do so until you guys went there first. And it kind of helped me find my voice on that issue. And there's been a couple of other times where you kind of threw a different drummer at me. It's rare that I interact as directly with the podcast as I have with the North and South of Things.
Well, we appreciate that. And I think there's, the trans topic, that just has had a meteoric rise in the last year or two. I'm not sure any social issue has had such an arc in terms of making more and more people aware, whether it's because of actors or well-known entities. But it's been fascinating to watch that just in 2 years. I mean, like the public knowledge and conversation about those issues is, off the scale now compared to what it was just 2 years ago. That's all because of us.
Well, I think it's important, especially when we're in a culture that has such trouble talking about grief and about loss. And, I think the way that we deal with grief and loss is changing. And, those of us who've, gone to school, we have our little psychology class, and in that psychology class, we talk about grief and loss. And I know for myself, I'm very familiar with what are called the five stages of grief and loss. Have you all heard of those?
Heard and experienced.
Indeed.
Absolutely. And I think as our understanding of human psychology and the mind grows, we have different frameworks. Now, this is a great framework to start with. There is some discussion in the psychology field that maybe these aren't exactly valid anymore, but I think it's a good framework to talk about grief and loss. And I know personally, we have denial and isolation. We have anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Those are the stages that we've all been taught. And I think there's nuance in between all of them. And people who are grieving do not necessarily go through the stages in any particular order or experience all of them. But I know personally for me, when you are dealing with loss and grief, there's a lot of emotions, and it's really important for you to really take the time to process through everything, because I know I've experienced in my life, if I am not processing through, like, say, the loss of my mother totally, what happens is your grieving stops. And then you kind of live your life and you're going about your day. And then another loss happens. And you start processing through that. And what that ends up doing is it kind of triggers the loss that came before. And it becomes very complex. And so it's really important for us from a mental health perspective to really work through those stages and really get some help if you need it. Because I know for me, there was, you know, a lot of the grieving that happened, especially with my parents who both went through extended illnesses, you are able to do some of that as you're going through it. And then there are other parts of it that you can't really even imagine until later on, especially for my own relationship with my mom. It was a very tumultuous one, and it took a really long time to deal with some of those things about forgiveness, some of the anger that I had, and that sort of thing.
Where are you in that process now?
I think there is still actually some work to do with the relationship with my mom. Mm-hmm. And the one sticking point is because I could see her potential of being a better person, but she never got there. And I think I'm a little bit more forgiving with my father for some reason. It just comes down to if you know better, you do better. And I'm trying mm-hmm. to resolve because I think my mother knew better, but she wasn't doing better. And that's that, mm-hmm. that I still continue to deal with even to this day.
Interesting. Greg, do you, in hearing Mark talk, do you, in your work in the faith community, do you counsel people? Do you work with people, whether informal or formal, folks who are dealing with loss of life, loss of a relationship, et cetera? And do you subscribe to that sort of five stages of grief and loss?
I am very informal. I've had people in the past suggest that I ought to be a pastor, and I think I know better. So everything I do is sort of on the side, but I think that can be extremely helpful. I've told people at church before that one of the number one reasons I don't sing in the choir is that it's really helpful to have somebody out in the congregation who's actually singing, you know, that someone who's sitting next to somebody who can reinforce. I guess the number one thing I'd like to say is what I don't do and what I don't subscribe to. And that's the everything is in God's plan mentality. Yeah, whether there's truth in that or not, it's absolutely not helpful. So I don't go that road. As far as the stages of grief go, I do believe in them, and I do think that I've experienced them. But I like some meme I saw online at some point that drew the five stages out as if it was some sort of linear path. And the person said, mm-hmm. my experience of this is more like a Jackson Pollock painting, you know, that you don't complete stage two and get a certificate because you're not angry anymore. We've had an interesting run as a family, and I think our family's experience lately has been a bit more like Adam Burns' experience with his grandmother, because he had a loss in mm-hmm. the midst of all this too, where he was trying to get to her bedside and missed the mark due to, you know, planes and hotels and other issues. And although I'm sure he knew that it was fine for him to not be there at that moment, he also was making the effort. And we had a couple of people who were coming to town to stay with us to see my wife's dad, knowing that he was imminently going to die. And my wife's brother was a day late. And the nephew, who I think had the best relationship with him, was a day late. And it's really heartbreaking to see people who wanted to be there and couldn't. So what I tend to do is try to ground things in reality a little bit and let them know that, well, first off, the week before he passed, he wasn't that conscious anyway. So you don't have to worry about what the person who has died perceives. That for mm-hmm. my Christian worldview, I think my father-in-law has gone from a place of limited and decreasing knowledge due to dementia and other health issues to a place of greater knowledge than he's ever had before, if you believe in a concept of some sort of heaven or afterlife. So I don't think we need to worry. And I tell people, you don't need to worry too much about what grandma perceived or what your father or father-in-law perceived, and that you should take that burden completely off your list. It's more about dealing with a new stage in the relationship where the person's not around anymore. That's where the healing needs to start.
Yeah. Mark, that's obviously been your experience too, in terms of this linear path versus Jackson Pollock, right? It's not, until we were preparing for this episode, I don't think I realized it wasn't in that order, because you know, you always hear about them and they're rattled off one after the other, but your experience was
absolutely
exact too.
And it, with every loss, it's never the same. You have to take each experience as its own thing, and it's not necessarily going to unfold in the same way, because, you know, we're so multifaceted and our relationships are so complex with each other that it really depends on what your relationship was like. If it was healthy or unhealthy, there are probably some other issues that you have to deal with besides, you know, the grief and the loss part of things.
Yeah. I, you know, for me, my first dealings with death, didn't happen until I was a senior in college. And it was my sister. She died of stomach cancer at age 29. And someone literally came, I was attending a college about an hour away from where my family lived. And someone literally came in my night class and said, we need you. And, you know, had to go back home. And, you know, she died 2 days later, but that it occurs to me that in a minute, we're going to talk a little bit about how death is and grief is marked around the world. And previewing that, in Japan, they teach their children early on about death. It's not, whereas, you know, in it feels like in our society, unless you experience death early on, it's not talked about until the first experience when it happens. And I can tell you, that is something that hit me like a ton of bricks at, you know, at age, I had been like 19 or 20, as a junior in college. Yeah, I was a junior in college, not a senior. That was weird. That was probably one of the worst sort of sense of loss I've ever had. You know, life goes on for the rest of us. And since 2013, I've lost two brothers, my father, my best friend, and my dog. So after a while, you just get the sense that, you know, this is life. Life is a loss. But Greg, what was your first experience with loss?
You know, the truth is, when I saw that question was going to be part of it, I had to think for a minute, because I don't really dwell on it, but I must have been somewhere around 9 or 10 years old when my grandfather on my mother's side died. And my parents, I think, did a pretty good job of trying to make sure that the kids were aware that this circle of life had a natural course. And, you know, my grandfather had lived, you know, quite a long life. My other grandfather preceded, he died before I was born. So this was the first time that I had a loved one disappear on me, so to speak. And, you know, we were attending the funeral, but, you know, the funny thing about that, and probably my dominant memory, is, how important it was for me to behave right, which I think might be the wrong message as far as it goes. Not being a distraction to mom or grandma was a higher priority, perhaps, than me sort of dealing with the fact that when we got back to my grandparents' house, Harry was never going to be there again. So.
Mm. How old were you?
9 or 10. Yeah, pretty young.
Yeah.
And it was not an easy thing sort of to get your head around at that age. But, you know, at the same time, your mom and your dad have to deal with their own sort of experience of losing the eldest male member of the family.
Right. Mark, what was your first
I have three events that you know, thinking about and preparing for the show, there are three points in my life where I had to deal with death, and each was pretty significant and sort of basically informed the rest of my experience. And the first one was the first time I ever saw a dead body. It was my father's great aunt's wake. And this is at a time where, you know, I grew up Catholic. So the open casket sort of funeral experience was the norm of the day. But I knew how unsettling it was. And I was very young. I was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 10, somewhere in that age range. And just, you know, because when people are alive, they have kind of this animated spirit about them. And I could tell when I was a small child that there was nothing there. It was an empty shell, and it was very unsettling for me as a young boy who was sensitive to everyone around him, that seeing this for the first time, that was the first experience. The second experience was somebody very close to me. It was my grandfather, so my father's father, who had been caretaking my grandmother, who had Alzheimer's and dementia, and we had no idea how bad it was. But basically what had happened is he had a health emergency, was hospitalized, and then cancer was diagnosed. And he got to the same memory care facility where my grandmother was, and he was out of the hospital. And he basically said he didn't want to live anymore because he had gone down to visit my grandmother and she did not recognize him. And everybody else was like, "Oh, Grandpa, you don't really mean that." And I was the one, I think I was in my early 20s, where I sat down with him and I basically held his hand and I said it was okay for him to go. And that I understood that he was tired, that he didn't want to go on anymore, that he had nothing else really to live for. And I was the only one. And then I went home and I just, oh man, I lost it. But he didn't, I think he lasted another two and a half weeks and then he passed on. And the third significant,
how old
I was in my 20s. So it was a while before I, you know, really lost someone that was close to me. That was the instance where I lost somebody that was very close to me. And the
it's interesting that in that at that age range, right, Greg, like in your 20s, like you're invincible. It's not just your teenage years, but you like that's the height of invincibility before you really start having a car payment or a house payment or something like that. And to have to deal with something like that, Mark did at that age, like that brings it down real, brings life to reality real quick. Yeah,
for me, I didn't have that issue. The only death in the family for me in the 20s was a grandmother that I did not communicate with. So I didn't feel that acutely and have to deal with that collision of thinking that life is forever and dealing with life is not in such a kind of record needle scratching vinyl kind of a way. For me, I was my deaths in my immediate family and the people who are really close to me kind of happened in my 30s and beyond. And by then, you know, I was married. We had one child when my dad died. And so I'd sort of become much more acutely aware of how fragile life is and how important it is to pass things on. So I'd kind of crossed that threshold from 20s to 30s pretty fully. And then a decade or so later, my older sister died, sort of like yours, 39 instead of 29, but yeah, way too young from cancer. And that sort of, you know, kind of brought its own set of challenges because that was the first time in my life I felt like, well, I felt so powerless. When your parents died, it's devastating, but you know that they're older than you and that's going to happen. I just did not have a way of processing the fact that a sister who was 2 years older than me would be gone so soon. It really hit me hard.
Yeah. Mark, you had a third.
Yeah. The third was probably one of the most powerful experiences that I've had in my life. And I was actually present at the death of my grandfather that was my mother's father. And I have to say, you know, looking back on that experience, it was such an honor, really, for me to be there, because what had happened is the night before, my mom called me and said, if you want to say goodbye, you should probably come up. And they were about an hour and a half away from my house. And so that next day, my father and I drove up, and my mom had told my grandfather that I was coming, and that he actually rallied through the night and hung on. And I got there in the morning, and after I arrived, it wasn't very much longer where he actively started to die. And he was surrounded by his family, his wife, my mom, my cousins, his grandchildren, and even some of his great-grandchildren. And it was a very powerful experience. It's something that I will never forget, and is just kind of indicative of the mystery of life and what happens at the end. It was just very powerful. And I think if everyone had that kind of experience in our culture, I think we would really deal with death and loss in a different way.
Yeah. Certainly with those in the older age population. My sister's passing was my first experience with death, and pretty traumatic. I was actually taken aback even more by the passing of my friend David. He was my best friend, not a former ex-boyfriend or anything, just a friend from college, and we stayed friends long after college. And in 2013, I got a call from his boyfriend asking if I'd heard from David. And I had not. We usually talked every day, but it was a bit unusual that I hadn't heard from him on Sunday. And I've been trying to give him some space. We talk every day. He now has had a boyfriend. I was trying to not, you know, call every single day to, you know, give him some peace. But we were super close friends. We traveled together, did a lot of stuff together. Come to find out, he had had a heart attack the night before. And hearing that message, I'm in the middle of the workplace at my desk when I hear it. And it was probably the single most painful thing I've ever had to deal with, you know, in a workspace too. That was difficult. How do you guys, we all go through it. We all have friends who go through it. What would be your recommendation for someone listening to this, in terms of how they could cope or how they could start the process?
I think one of the most important things is to have a support network. Reach out to your friends and family, and just say, hey, this is happening or has just happened, and this is what I'm dealing with. I think a lot of people are afraid that they're going to say something wrong or behave in a way that isn't appropriate. And there's no wrong way of dealing with grief. We all do it differently. And I think it's really important for us to stay connected to our friends and family when something like this happens. And I think the best thing that anyone can do is just simply be there and just be able to listen.
Yeah.
Ask them.
So if you're the person who's had the loss, don't be afraid to let your close friends and family know you've had this loss and this is what you're dealing with. But if you're a friend of somebody, be there. don't let awkwardness sort of be the enemy of being there for that person. I think that's great advice. Greg, what do you think? What would be your advice for somebody going through?
Yep. If you're the person who's had the loss, and you know, obviously you make an exception if behavior is truly self-destructive or inappropriate toward other people. But to me, the most important thing is to not beat yourself up over those sorts of things. Unexpected displays of grief, things of that nature. Anger is appropriate. It's one of those stages we talked about earlier. To me, it's really important that people allow themselves to grieve and not be self-conscious. And one of the things I refuse to allow myself to be self-conscious about is a sense that there still is a relationship with that person who is gone. Faith perspective is perhaps not the most popular within Christianity today, but it's extremely orthodox. It ties back to the ideas of C.S. Lewis just within the last 100 years or so. And it's that there's a notion of eternal now, that if you believe that there is an afterlife, whether you call it heaven or whatever, and that there's some future moment of spiritual reunion, that isn't there's no past and future per se, that we're experiencing a relationship with people today that is different than it was before. But, you know, with my mom, that was also true, what the relationship was like when I was a kid versus in college versus the last couple years before she died. And it's not inappropriate to feel like there is still some communicating that needs to be done. And I know some folks in Christian circles who would view that as some sort of unacceptable superstition, but nothing can be further from the truth. Mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis's notion of God is that God is living in an eternal now, that there is no past or present or future concept for those who are spiritual, because it's all happening at once. And therefore, I think the most healthy thing that I've latched onto in my grief and that I've tried to help other people with is memory. You know, that person is alive to mm-hmm. you as long as you remember things. And where I've had conflict within my family, for example, at the death of my mom, are when people push back against that notion of memory. If there are stories they prefer not be told, or if they live with a paradigm of time to forget. I don't believe there's a time to forget.
I definitely strikes a chord with me, this notion of memory, like keeping that person alive. You know, in today's world, we all have an amazing camera on our phone, and I try to use it liberally, especially when around friends, because you just never know, you know, when that last moment is, and being able to have those things to reflect on, photos, videos, or simply just remembering your times together. I think that's definitely a beautiful thing. Bargaining, this stage of bargaining, have either of you experienced that? At first I thought bargaining was like, you know, for the person who is dying, maybe of cancer, Lord, please don't take me. I'm not ready. Like, but it's more, is it more, you know, I'll go in her place, where you're sort of trying to say to the gods or God that, you know, I want to be in place for that person, or if you will do this, I will do that.
There's a line in the song, the Gone Away by the Offspring, a heavy metal band, that where the song happens at a graveside, and the character says, if I could trade, I would. And I think that's one element of bargaining. The other element of bargaining isn't quite as dramatic as that. It's all the subtle if-onlys that happen when sort of dealing with grief. If only I could have been there on time. If only I hadn't said this. All that sort of stuff.
I see. Yeah, I see. I see. Yeah, there's a country song when you were talking about the Offspring, a song, Lord, it's a tearjerker. Please don't take the girl. I can't remember.
Oh, yeah, the Tim McGraw song. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Mark, if you've never heard that song, listen to it. But have a box of Kleenex nearby.
I imagine that song as a prayer. I think the song's got a little bit of a songwriting flaw, in that in a perfect world, the whole song could have happened in the waiting room of the surgery. You know, that's how I picture each one of those steps along the way. I'm getting choked up. Each one of those steps along the way is a memory kind of being dealt with by the person who's stuck waiting to find out what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I heard that the other day for some reason. It came up and I went to YouTube and played it. And shoo. That and Vince McGill, Vince Gill's Go Rest High on That Mountain. Mm-hmm. That is that, of course, bluegrass music. I think because of where I come from in the hills of Virginia, you know, that's music of the people, and hearing that kind of song at somebody's passing is also, yeah, music can be a way of helping people deal with memories and dealing with that too. It's interesting. Mark, is it time we take a trip around the world?
Absolutely. So we wanted to kind of touch on a few different cultures and how they deal with loss and with grief. And let's start with maybe our neighbors to the south.
Don't give me that look. Día de los Muertos is the one night of the year our ancestors can come visit us.
We've put their photos on the ofrenda
so their spirits can cross over. That is very important. If we don't put them up, they can't come.
We made all this food, set out the things they loved in life, mijo. All this work to bring the family together.
That's an audio clip from the Pixar Disney movie Coco from 2017, which won quite a few awards. I just loved the movie. Learned a lot about the holiday, Dia de Muertos. Apparently, in Anglophile countries, we add a los in the middle there, Dia de los Muertos. But apparently, the folks in Mexico and in places that actually celebrate it drop the los. So, Dia de Muertos. It's a Mexican holiday celebrated, particularly in central and south regions, by people of Mexican heritage elsewhere as well. Scholars trace the holiday back to indigenous observances dating all the way back to Aztec festivals. Today, it's a multi-day holiday. It involves family and friends gathering to pray and remember friends and family who've died and help support their spiritual journey. There's a writer who, Mark, Frances Ann Day, how does she describe the holiday?
Well, in Latina and Latino voices in literature, on October 31st, which is All Hallows Eve, the children make a children's altar to invite the angelitos, or the spirits of dead children, to come back for a visit. And then on November 1st is All Saints Day, and the adult spirits will come to visit. And then on November 2nd is All Souls Day, when the families actually go to the cemetery to decorate the graves, tombs, and resting places of their relatives. Now, the three-day festival is filled with marigolds, the flowers of the dead, muertos, the bread of the dead, sugar skulls. I'm sure we've all seen pictures of that. Cardboard skeletons, tissue paper decorations, fruit, nuts, incense is burned, and other traditional foods and decorations are placed around the cemetery.
I have to say, early on, you know, we've all heard of Day of the Dead for a while, unless you really dug in and understand what it is. You just, oh, it's that Mexican Halloween, which it's not. And the skulls, I always thought was kind of morbid and gross and like how inappropriate. But, you know, the more I learn, and I'm not going to lie, watching that movie Coco really sort of tipped the scale. And now I see that paper skull as absolutely gorgeous in all of the color and ways it's displayed. I was curious about the connect, like, is there a connection between our Halloween and the Day of the Dead? And while they're sort of similar timing, they're not really connected at all. Is my general understanding right now. You know, Halloween is one night, whereas the Day of the Dead is three. And it has, you know, All Hallows Eve, the night before All Saints Day, and then All Souls Day following All Saints Day. Greg, have you had much interaction with this holiday?
No, like you, cocoa for me was a bit of a revelation. And you know, somebody who is very partial to surrealism, I absolutely enjoyed the way, not just the way it was, the story was told, but the way the story was animated. I mean, I think our traditional Halloween sort of trick or treat candy kind of concepts probably trace more back to Ireland and Scotland than they do to mm-hmm. South America.
Right.
So you're right about that. The timing is the same, and some of the inspiration behind the timing is the same. But the biggest difference is when I was growing up, too much talk about spirits and spirituality at Halloween would have been viewed as suspect and frowned upon. It would have been viewed as some sort of supernatural occultism, where in Mexican culture, that's not the case at all. It's very much kind of that's eternal now concept I've got of saying, hey, this is still a family. This is a family that's at a different stage. And for them, there's a time of year to have a family celebration.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I do wonder if you juxtapose the conversations we've been having about sort of how sometimes we struggle with closure and we struggle with coping, and you know, then societal celebrations or holidays like Dia de los Muertos. See, I put the los back in there. There's a process. You're not losing the person, right? Because you're going to celebrate them next year and the year after that and the year after. And I wonder if sometimes these other cultural ways of dealing with this is, you know, much smarter than ours.
You know, one of the other country songs we didn't mention earlier was a Lyle Lovett song called Family Reserve. Not so much dealing with the moment of death or with funeral or things after funeral, but more or less kind of set in the wake of saying, you know, what does the family do when a member of the family dies? And in some cases, it's breaking out the best wine and sharing both tears and laughter.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, Family Reserve is a really wonderful song. One of the things in that Day of the Dead story that kind of resonates with me in an interesting way is that notion of decorating the graveside. Mm-hmm. In my family, we don't have that. My wife's parents are buried, but they're buried like, you know, a time zone and a half away. So there's no real visiting that graveside for us. And on my side of the family, we've used cremation, meaning they're really one of the challenges when you've chosen cremation as a method is, what do you do? Do you leave an urn on the mantle place from now on? Or do you do a scattering? Has that scattering been pre-planned? Has the dead person given some indication of what they want done with their ashes? You don't want a Big Lebowski situation where you end up, you know, failing at that last moment of scattering the ashes. And that's sort of where we are. But once that's done, we don't necessarily go back to the rose bush we scattered dad's ashes underneath.
Right.
In fact, that park doesn't even exist anymore. It's probably a sidewalk or a street now. So
interesting. And have you heard of any other ways that people handle we have a similar situation. My friend scattered some of his ashes, or his husband or partner scattered his ashes, and then we buried the urn. And I have to say that was, it was at a family gravesite on the side of a hill in Hayside, Virginia. And they're, you know, not connected to a funeral home. So it was us with a shovel and a pothole digger, if you know what that is. And at the end, literally on our hands and knees, pulling dirt out of there with our hands, which was surreal. I mean, you know, you're just like, I've got dirt under my fingernails because I'm putting my friend in the ground, you know.
The one thing I like about it is that, yes, it isn't, there's nothing corporate about it. It's the family, it's the friends, whatever you're going to do, you do yourself. Mm-hmm. But really for the first time, maybe this weekend, I've seen an idea that I'd never seen before, because my wife, I think, is a little bit put off by, she's made it very clear. There will be no urn. There'll be no mantle place for her. She doesn't want to be enshrined in any way. And that probably includes a formal burial. She's more interested in the scattering. But I read just this weekend that in Korea, there is a growing trend of people taking those ashes and refining them and turning them into beads. colorful nice. Beads.
Wow.
Now, not jewelry to be worn, but they say that if you visit a Korean home, it's not unusual to see places in the house where we might have old family pictures. There might be beads there, and that's sort of a very a kind of a humble way almost of dealing with it. And I've always been a big fan of marbles. So yeah. This is my wheels are actually turning in terms of what's the right thing to do with those ashes. I'm going to look into this a little bit more just to see, is that a better way to go than just, finding a spot out on Lake Erie and, or whatever,
Fascinating. I know when I lost my pet, and even before that, when David passed and he was cremated, the funeral home showed us a whole directory, a whole catalog of things that you can have sort of produced out of the remaining carbon. It's fascinating. That's incredible. Mark, where else around the globe do we think people are doing interesting things?
Well, Japan is an interesting culture where they teach their children right after birth about death. And, it's considered taboo in many countries and here as well, that you don't explain death to a child until necessity brings it forth. But in Japanese culture, children learn at a very young age that death is imminent. They are taught to respect their elders as they move through the cycles of life. And it is fascinating. And in Japan, death is a very involved process. People who know the deceased must offer their condolences every year on the anniversary of the loved one's death. They continue these rituals periodically until everyone who has ever known that person has also passed. And often after the person has passed, they are cremated, but at a very low temperature so that the bones may be preserved. And then they are placed in an ornamental grave that was purchased for them by their parents when they were actually born.
So now I'm not sure how I feel about that. I'm not sure about how I feel about the remaining bones because you were cremated at a low temperature. That feels a little icky to me. I don't know.
Well, and then family members visit those grave sites for the first 15 days after the person has passed. And then afterwards, they slowly continue to drop visit days until they are just visiting on the anniversary of the deceased person's death. Now, one of the things that I find interesting is we have a pretty big Asian population here in the Twin Cities. And I love visiting our older historic cemeteries, and they have different sections for different peoples. And there is an Asian section, which is fascinating to visit because you'll actually go there on like a sunny day like it is today. It's going to be 64 degrees and people will visit the cemetery and they'll often put out offerings of what that person enjoyed in life. And I remember specifically walking through the cemetery and all of these offerings. And I came across a gravesite of an elderly military person. And it was fascinating because at the gravesite, there were little coffee candies that were set on a paper plate because this is something that he enjoyed. And I got to learn more about the people that were there simply by what was being offered.
That's amazing. Not unlike the Dia de la Muertos, where at the offerings, at the altar, they put pictures and things that the deceased had enjoyed or participated in. That's fascinating. So, guys, this has been a great conversation. If you are listening to this and you have recently experienced loss, I hope the thing you take away is there's no wrong way to mark that loss or to grieve that loss. But a common, I apologize for that beeping in the background. But a common theme is be with somebody, talk with somebody, don't be shy about sort of sharing, how you're feeling, and you know, take the time to care for yourself. Any final thoughts, Greg?
Find a way to tell your story. You know, that if you want to be thoughtful of others in terms of how they may deal with your death after you're gone, whether it's in writing or in journaling or what I do is podcasting, find a way to tell your story. I was shocked a couple of years ago that a classmate of mine who I barely knew had died very young and very suddenly. And I was suddenly hungry for information about Hillary that I didn't think I was going to be able to get. And then I found out that not long before she died, she'd recorded a live performance art piece through the Oral Fixation show in Dallas, Texas. And I was able to go online in YouTube and see her tell her story. And it really created a closure for me that was incredibly powerful. Again, barely knew her. But at the moment I thought, I wish I'd known her better, she'd given me away. It was great.
That's amazing. wow. What a gift that was.
Yep.
Mark, any final thoughts?
You know, when an event like a loss happens, there's a lot of activity. You know, you have a lot of contact. What I like to do with someone who has experienced loss is to really check in with them, especially like a month afterwards, because I think a lot of people just want to move on with their life. And when they experience grief and loss, it's going to take some time, and you just don't put it in a box and place it on the mantle. You deal with this, and it's human, and it's important for us as a community to kind of check in with each other and say, hey, how are you doing? I know this is difficult. What can I do for you?
You hit the nail on the head too, because it's also at the moment that loss happens, there's a lot of friends and relatives and folks around. But you know, a month in, it's just you dealing with it. So checking back in with those friends is that's a smart bit too.
Yeah, be thoughtful about the impact of things like the first Christmas, the first Thanksgiving. Those sorts of things where the experience is going to be very different from the people who are left behind. And that's a really good point in time to check in and maybe invite somebody to your Thanksgiving table if their table is going to feel empty otherwise.
That's a great idea. That's wonderful. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Mark and I will be back. Greg, we appreciate your time. We're looking forward to listening to more of the Inappropriate Conversations and Walk the Earth podcast.
Yeah, I'm anticipating a move to Spotify. I say move, it's just sharing the link, but I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen with old shows when I do that, because I've recorded at a low bit rate historically, but I'm preparing myself to deal with whatever I need to do to make Inappropriate Conversations available through Spotify for the first time. That's probably going to happen between now and Thanksgiving too.
Excellent. Stay tuned, folks. Mark, we've got another topic coming up. I think, what are we going to tackle next? I think we're going to talk about the five senses, huh?
That's right. Sight, smell, taste, touch. What else?
What was that last one?
Touch.
I didn't hear you.
Right. Awesome. Well, we appreciate your time, folks, for listening to today's show, and we'll be back soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The North and South of Things. More information available at northandsouthofthings.com. Follow Mark on Twitter at Laughing Buddha. That's LaffingBuddha. And George at George in Atlanta. Our podcast theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.
This show is part of the Pride 48 Network. Find more shows over at pride48.com.